Good morning to you all. Welcome to the 2021 Wesley Studies Symposium at Tyndale. I'm glad you've chosen to join us for this event taking place for the 11th time. I wish we could be together, but I'm thankful for the technology that's allowing us to meet virtually and which is enabling some people to join us who would not have been able to make the trip to Toronto for an in-person event. The Wesley Symposium is a forum to share research on the Wesleyan tradition and research by Wesleyans on various subjects of interest to Wesleyans. And we have both types of presentations on the schedule today. I hope you're going to enjoy the day and find that it stimulates your mind, but also inspires you in some way and equips you for Christian life and mission. And as we begin the day, I would like to first welcome Dr. Arnold Neufeld Fast. He is the Dean of Tyndale Seminary, and I'll ask him to bring greetings.
Thank you, James, and welcome to everyone. It's indeed my privilege to welcome you here to Tyndale Seminary. I wish we could meet in this space behind me. Okay, it's virtual, it's in my house, but perhaps next year we'll be together at Tyndale. The Wesleyan denominations, the Free Methodist, Nazarene, Salvation Army, and Wesleyan churches have been in partnership with Tyndale since 1993. That's a long time. And that developed into a number of initiatives like the funding of the Donald N. and Kathleen G. Bastian Chair of Wesley Studies, which our colleague James Pedler holds. Our creative partnership together gives opportunity for preparing pastors and lay leaders in the Wesleyan tradition a home here at Tyndale in this broader tent evangelical family. And there are many traditions around that table. And the Wesleyan holiness tradition enriches everything that's happening around the table. And we're really thankful for this partnership. The annual symposium, James, you said this is the 11th, is just one of those gifts that has really enriched us over time. It started small and it has now grown to, I think we have 217 people registered for today. It's stunning, actually. And so is the content that's happening, the agenda, online pastoral education. We're talking about that every day at Tyndale. Scripture, theology, grace, communion, formation, ethics, and an analysis of the state of flourishing congregations in Canada today. At Tyndale, all things considered, it's been a good year. Online education seems to have been embraced by the vast majority of graduate students. And we also now have approval from our accrediting body, ATS, to deliver our entire MDiv and MTS curriculums and programs in a distance format, so online. But the Wesleyan chairholder was a pioneer of some of this even pre-pandemic. So James Pedler knows your constituency and has delivered courses in a virtual manner even prior to the outbreak of COVID. So in that sense, we're continuing with some of those gifts that are here around the table. And I think we're all now very familiar and comfortable with online video conferencing, et cetera. And like other institutions, we're looking ahead for next year and we're just not sure yet. We're hopeful that we can gather together. If so, we're not sure how closely we can gather together. But one of the things we do know is that Dr. Pedler will be offering a course on holiness Monday afternoons, and that will be accessible via live stream one way or another, and church renewal in the winter. So maybe that's of interest to you. So in any case, despite COVID, it's an exciting time to be doing theological education. And we're really glad for this event and everything that will be happening today. And I wish you God's richest blessings for the rest of today. Thank you.
Thank you, Arnold. It's good of you to be with us this morning. As you have seen in the email instructions that we sent to you, we are asking that you keep your microphones muted, and we also recommend that you turn off your cameras. I know that might seem a bit unfriendly, but the reason is so that we can maximize the bandwidth for the presenter during each presentation. And there is an opportunity for question and answer after the presentations, and you may be called on to participate, and at that point you can unmute and turn on your camera. So we are going to have discussion after each paper, and if you have a question that you'd like to pose, we ask that you would put it into the chat. So I will, as a moderator, I will keep my eye on the chat, and I will pick questions to pass along to the presenter. I may call on you to share your question, or I may just read it. And I'll be moderating the panels today, the papers today, except for Chris Pikes, which will be moderated by Adam Klein, and Jason Mills, which will be moderated by Dan Sheffield. Now, it's our pleasure to welcome Dr. Joel Thiessen as our keynote speaker today. Dr. Thiessen is a professor of sociology at Ambrose University, where he also directs the Flourishing Congregations Institute. He has an impressive list of publications, including his book, The Meaning of Sunday, The Practice of Belief in a Secular Age, and another book, None of the Above, Non-Religious Identity in the U.S. and Canada, with Sarah Wilkins LaFlamme. And most recently, Signs of Life, Catholic, Mainline, and Conservative Protestant Congregations in Canada, authored with Bill McAlpine, Keith Walker, and Arch Wong, and published by our own Tyndale Academic Press this year. So Dr. Thiessen has established himself as a leading authority on the sociology of religion in Canada, and he's also a man of faith. He cares about the gospel, and he wants to see the church flourish and use his intellectual gifts and expertise in order to help the church to flourish in its God-given mission. He's also part of the Wesleyan family as a member of the Nazarene Church. Now, please welcome me now join me in welcoming Dr. Joel Thiessen.
Great, thanks, James. I'm going to share my screen here. Give me one sec. All right. I was saying to James earlier on that I feel like I have the jet lag this morning, minus the actual jet. So a couple hours earlier here in Alberta, but great to be with you. Of course, wish we were all in person. I am, as has been noted, a sociologist of religion, and I'm also deeply committed to the local church. Among other things that I'm involved in, chair the local board of Nazarene Church here in Calgary, and I care deeply about our church and our denomination, along with my work as a sociologist of religion. As a sociologist of religion, my work is very much grounded in empirical data. And my own bias is that churches can benefit greatly by leaning into empirical data in ways that actually inform practice. And I'm going to provide a few examples in a moment before I jump into the actual core area of my talk, looking at signs of life and vitality in Canadian churches. Three brief examples to perhaps demonstrate from different areas of my research over the years on discoveries that might have been surprising to me or potentially to churches that are grounded in data that might inform practice. A first example, and as James mentioned, one of my earlier books, The Meaning of Sunday, and then more recently in None of the Above, drawing on interview data with individuals who attend religious services mainly for religious holidays and rites of passage, and those who say they have no religion. We've heard many different surveys and studies that talk about this group of individuals across Canada who potentially desire greater involvement in local congregations. And what I've discovered as you talk to such individuals is that, contrary to what they might say on surveys, that they aren't necessarily open to greater levels of involvement in local congregations. Or more pointedly, when you have congregations who operate with the premise that, you know, if we just have better music or better preaching or better programming, that this will yield greater involvement, we find this isn't actually true. And I think from a practitioner perspective, it would be wise to pay attention to some of this kind of empirical data so that we aren't operating with well-intentioned but perhaps misguided assumptions assumptions when we make different decisions on the ground. In fact, we know from empirical data that, of course, better music and better preaching and programming are important to give attention to, but this primarily intersects with retaining those who are already within one's congregation or drawing people from other congregations, what we call transfer growth. So it's not that we don't pay attention to these things, but we need to be clear about the actual effect on the other end of such things. So one example for some of my earlier work where data might inform practice in some different ways. Another area of interest for me is millennials in Canada, and I'm often asked the question in different settings, you know, are millennials from another planet? There's this sense that younger people are completely different in how they view the world, how they experience the world, and so forth. And yet we find Dr. Reginald Bibby and Dr. Minetta Bailey and I in our recent book, The Millennial Mosaic, is that millennials in Canada today are far more similar than dissimilar to previous generations of young people. There are some exceptions, of course, when you look at young people's views on sexuality or gender, certainly quite different than older generations or younger people of earlier generations. And yet, what we find is that there's a lot more in common than not in common between young people today and young people of previous generations, as well as older generations today. And there you see the top five values, for example, that are common across generational groups of freedom, family life, being loved, friendship, and self-reliance as just one example among others. So my point is simply that when we look to empirical data, some of our common perceptions might not actually align with that data. And thus the question, how might this shape some of our practices in local congregations? One final example that will be of interest to all of us is, you know, what impact is the pandemic having on congregations and what might this mean moving forward? And I think there's a lot of concern, a lot of angst from many church leaders in Canada today that, you know, people are going to leave the church because there aren't in-person services or people are not following online and so forth. And there are many studies that have come out over the last year. And if you visit our website at the Institute, and I'll provide that on the next slide, we have about a dozen or more studies related to the pandemic and congregations. And here before us, we see one that came out just a few weeks ago by the Angus Reid Institute. One of the best ones, I would say, that's come out related to congregations and the pandemic here in Canada. And what you find when you look at that data is that the main storyline is, while there are some clear drawbacks, and I'm sure we could all name those drawbacks, most say that they are doing okay spiritually. Most, particularly among weekly attenders prior to the pandemic, have remained connected to others in their congregation. They've watched or attended services during the pandemic, and they plan to return to in-person services post-pandemic. And so these are the kinds of data points that I think might be helpful for us to know to then think about, okay, what decisions might we make in our local church context? So what I want to do in our time together today is turn to some of our work at the Flourishing Congregations Institute, and in particular, this recently released book, Signs of Light, to look at interview data with over 100 Catholic, mainline, and conservative Protestant leaders, church leaders, denominational leaders across the country, as well as survey data with over 250 churches and over 9,100 participants, mostly congregants within these congregations, to look at different dynamics and aspects of congregational life. I'm not, for the sake of time, going to go through all the methodological details, but if you're interested, I can answer some questions afterwards related to those. But I'm going to look at three particular areas today. I'm going to look at innovation, neighborhood involvement, and evangelism, topics that I think will be of interest across the Wesleyan spectrum. And I think here during the pandemic and coming out of the pandemic might be of interest as well. Final thing I'll say just by way of introduction here is we provide resources related to some of our research and data on our website and on social media. So I encourage you to check that out. We have a newsletter that we put out a couple times a month with empirical data, as well as some practitioner reflections, theological reflections on what all of this might mean for local church settings. So you can access some of those things on our website as well for those who are interested. So one of the first logical questions that many will ask is, what do you mean by a flourishing congregation? How do you actually define that? And, you know, there's a strong debate, and we certainly see this within our research as well, a debate between, does flourishing entail numeric growth and church growth, or can it happen in the absence of? And there's strong polarized views, I would say, on either end of that continuum. And I'm not here to ultimately land on that, other than to say sociologically, of course, you need some kind of numeric threshold for an organization to actually survive and hopefully thrive. So numbers do matter, but it's not the total story. I would also point out that there's an important question to ask of are all numbers equal, or is all church growth equal? And by this, I mean, you know, if you think that evangelism is important and a central anchor to what a congregation does, and a church is growing quite rapidly, but it's growing primarily in means other than evangelism, that is, it's growing primarily from transfer growth from other congregations, would you say that this is a marker of flourishing? And of course, there'll be varied responses to that question, but it's the kind of nuance and complexity that I think is important to give attention to in dealing with this question. The second thing I would say is that no church flourishes in every way, and few churches are without flourishing in some way. And this we learned early on in our research is really, I think, insightful, because sometimes we have this perception that, you know, larger churches or ones that are growing must have everything working for them. And I think there's many examples and points of evidence where this isn't true. And likewise, and maybe more to the point, particularly for smaller congregations, this sense that, well, do we have any sign of flourishing within our congregational context? And one of the things we unpack in our research is that there might be, and indeed in many cases are, areas of flourishing in these 11 different areas that you see within the construct on the right-hand side of your screen. The final thing I'll say here is that these dimensions that you see before you are not mutually exclusive. There's points of overlap between them, and there's different points of emphasis within these different areas depending on theological sector. That is, you know, a Catholic or an Anglican or a Nazarene or Alliance or Pentecostal, Salvation Army, and so forth, might emphasize different areas of this construct as particularly salient or of interest for one's definition of flourishing. I think that's really important to keep in mind. This is not a one-size-fits-all narrative. Theology matters, and theology shapes what we ultimately deem to be important. And so with that as a bit of a pretext, I want to lean into ideas of innovation within organizational ethos, and then move to the outward dimension and look at areas of neighborhood involvement and evangelism. So looking at flourishing and innovation, when we speak of innovation, we are referring to the idea that a congregation introduces something new or alters something that is already established. And I think this is a really timely topic during the pandemic because all congregations, whether they wanted to or not, were basically forced into the position to innovate. And there are a range of successes or failures, if you will, in attempts to innovate, but there has been an introduction of something new, i.e. going online in various forms, along with other ministry areas, but also altering something new that has already been established. And one of the things that we learned in our research, of course, pre-pandemic, is many different areas and examples of congregations that are flourishing, where they were innovating, they were dreaming, they were trying new things, they were experimenting with a variety of different initiatives. And what was important to this group is that they did not interpret failure as failure, but rather they interpreted different initiatives, or quote unquote failures, if you will, as seeds for new ideas. That is, what do we learn from this attempt at something new that maybe didn't work out as we anticipated? And how did that actually contribute to the next new idea or area of innovation that contributed to what we have found and experienced within a congregation's life? And I find this image before us of a boat and water is quite helpful, that we heard some church leaders talk about this metaphor of getting out of the boat. What does it mean to get out of the boat, to take risks, to innovate, and to try something new? Unsure and uncertain of what the outcome might be, of taking that step of faith. And a repeated narrative among congregations that are flourishing is that we consistently stepped out of the boat. We tried something new, and we innovated and found a range of experiences on the other end of that experience. So have this metaphor In the background then, as we look to some of our survey data, and again, this survey data comes from over 250 Catholic, mainline, and conservative Protestant churches in all 13 provinces and territories across Canada, over 9,100 respondents, both leaders and congregants, but mostly congregants here. So we'll present some of that data. You'll see some comparisons here between congregations believed to be growing, staying the same, or declining. And I want to state here that I'm not inferring that just because you're growing, you are flourishing, or if you're declining, you're not flourishing. Yet when you look at the statistical data and compare among a variety of variables, this is consistently one of the strongest differentiators between different types of congregational contexts. And so I use this for hopefully a helpful lens to compare different group contexts. So here's one of the questions we asked on our survey. Which of the following best describes your congregation? Are you resistant to change, reluctant to change, ready and willing to change, or resilient in change? And what you find when you compare congregations believed to be growing relative to those who are declining is that they're far more likely to say that they're ready and willing to change or resilient in change, over 80% among growing congregations versus 44% among declining congregations. Now, this alone does not mean that a congregation is flourishing, and this alone does not mean that innovation has worked or what the particulars are of what that innovation entailed within a congregational setting. But it does reveal a particular posture, if you will. It is a way of thinking as an organization and individuals within that congregation that matters, that can set the context by which congregations take those steps forward. And so it's important for leaders to pay attention to, you know, what is the appetite, if you will, the temperature among our congregation for their level of readiness for change, because that sets the foreground for how much change you might actually lean into and the level of potential reception among congregants within one setting. So there is something, it seems, to be distinct within growing contexts in this respect. We also asked this question, again, this is pre-pandemic. If a person was away from your parish or congregation for 3 years and then came back, to what extent might they notice changes in how things are done? And again, you'll find within growing contexts, far more likely to say that you would find many noticeable changes, 35% versus 19% in declining contexts. And then more similarity, a few noticeable changes, 56% in growing, 61% in staying the same, and 51% in a few noticeable changes. Now, what I haven't done here, and we do in our book, A Sign of Life, is we provide some different examples of different kinds of changes. And it's somewhat beside my core point here, because innovation looks different in different church contexts, and what might be innovated in church A will not necessarily be innovative in church B, because the context is different based on who is within that congregation, the neighborhood context, the history of that church, and so forth. So it's important to pay attention to those things. But again, the underlying idea is that an openness to change, an openness to innovation, and then actually stepping into some of those areas is potentially important. It needs to be stated, however, that not all change is good. And I think it's wise for local church leaders and congregations to pay attention to, you know, what are the elements of tradition, the elements of what has made us to who we are today that is significant for who we are becoming moving forward, such that we're not just kind of changing all things just because, but rather asking the question, how might our core identity, the things that we are called to be and do as a congregation for this time and this place, shaping and informing the areas by which we might innovate moving forward, all the while giving attention to the things that we might hold on to moving forward. So it's not just that innovation in and of itself is inherently good or better, full stop, but it's giving measured entrances into this area and dynamic. And so some questions that I would put forward that are intended to help local church leaders think about and perhaps contextualize these things within their own setting. And I'll say that at the end of each chapter in Signs of Light, we provide different questions that would help churches and their boards and ministry leaders to reflect on particular questions, but also to have a few questions whereby you can actually kind of do a mini little survey of your own congregation to test some of these things out. So that's the spirit or intent of posing these kinds of questions. So where are the opportunities for your church to experiment, again, relative to your core identity or vision? And here I think there's a number of things that we can think about and take tangible steps toward in light of COVID. You know, COVID, depending on your perspective here, is a wonderful opportunity for congregations to give attention to the areas with which they might branch out into some new areas of ministry, of different forms and functions of how ministry looks. And churches that are wise within this period will not waste this opportunity. There is no time or space to grumble over the last year and whatever lay ahead of us for congregations who aspire to flourish. The space that is opened up is to say, how can we see this as an opportunity to actually leverage the ways in which we are ministering to those that we have been called to minister to? And so maybe those are online activities. Maybe it's reframing the content or the focus of our weekly liturgy. Yes, many of us are doing this because we need to, given regional restrictions and so forth. But the larger question is, what will this look like and mean for our weekly liturgy coming out of the pandemic? We include a postscript in our book, and we title it, "But There Is No Returning to Normal," right? There is no going back for congregations. Whatever you conceptualize as normal pre-pandemic, that will be the last time you saw and experienced that. And it's important for congregations to name that and potentially to grieve the losses where understandably so those losses exist. But to have an eye forward to say, okay, what will the new form of us look like, whatever that is? And that might involve adaptations to what our weekly liturgies look like. Congregant care, I think one of the things some congregations experienced early on in the pandemic is pastoral care and congregant care spreading out across the congregation so that congregants are calling one another rather than saying, actually, pastor, this is your job. Now you need to call all 100 people or 50 people or 300 people or what have you within our congregation. What does it look like to re-envision and equip and empower the laity to minister among and for one another within church settings? Midweek community gatherings. Of course, there's conventional ideas of small group settings and so forth. But there's also the informal gatherings of meeting up in people's backyards and around a fire pit and parking lot meetups and all these kinds of things. But I think there's some distinct opportunities. I know in our own church context here, have leveraged the opportunity for food trucks in our parking lots within all the standard local regional restrictions, etc. But it's been a great community opportunity to interact with members in our community. So these are just examples, but really the question for all of us to consider is, where might our church actually experiment relative to our core identity and vision? A second question and opportunity is to imagine the new and imaginative on-ramps for people to be connected or get involved. How do people who first intersect with our congregational settings actually become more involved over the course of time? And in particular right now, those who are watching online services. I hear some church leaders are quite excited, and perhaps rightly so, about those who are watching their services from afar, and they see sort of their numbers going up based on the number of views. And I think we need to hold those numbers with a high degree of caution. There's lots within the analytics that would help us to better understand what that data actually means or not. But I think the question is, how do we invite those who are watching online into deeper levels of connection and involvement with one's congregation? And I think congregations who are giving attention to that, who are providing some tangible structures and processes and steps to draw people in, will be quite prudent, not just now, but also after the pandemic. And we have lots of research prior to the pandemic that congregations who are flourishing in part have some clear structures and processes to help toward this end. One final question regarding innovation is how might board and finance decisions help to equip and or empower staff and lay leaders to try new initiatives? There's nothing worse for leaders to have ideas and to be told by its congregation or ministry leaders, et cetera, say, yes, go try these new ideas, but you're not actually resourced for success. And so this raises the possibilities of decisions, both at a board level or finance level, to provide some fuel to the fire. How are we going to set you up for success? And with that, what areas might we say, you know, we're actually going to turn our attention away from this and over to this? So we might actually reallocate some of our funding or human resources, et cetera, to actually help create a good possibility for success within a particular area. So some questions that hopefully will be helpful to congregations as they think about the ways in which innovation might actually come to pass within their setting. A second area that I want to look at here pertains to the neighborhood. And more than any other topic in our conversation with church leaders across the country, this one arose in this way, that if your church is not involved in its community or neighborhood, many leaders of flourishing congregations would say you cannot actually flourish. In other words, you can do all these other things that we talk about within that larger construct, but if you're not doing this one thing, then this is a significant opportunity with which congregations ought to think about. And here we often heard this question, and I suspect that many of you have heard this, maybe even raised this in your own setting. Would our neighborhood notice if we were no longer here? And it's a dangerous question to ask. It's an honest question. And as a social scientist, it's a question that we need to ask. We need to look in the mirror and ask that question and answer the question honestly to give us a point of departure by which we actually engage within the community around. In a few moments, we'll look at evangelism, but as a pretext for looking at evangelism, I think this conversation of engaging one's neighborhood is an important one to also thinking about and leveraging that conversation on evangelism as well. And so we asked some questions in our survey. Here we asked their level of agreement on this statement, your parish or congregation has an active presence in the wider community. And here you find 74% among those in growing context say that their churches have an active presence in the community versus 50% within a declining congregational setting. Again, we think there are some clear differences between growing and declining contexts in this respect. And you always have to think about these things relative to a series of other variables. In other words, you can't just look at this single question or this single topic of neighborhood to capture the total sum of flourishing, but it can be an important marker in one area of flourishing in congregations' life. We then asked survey respondents whether they believe that their neighborhood would notice if they were no longer there. And here you find 80% in growing context versus 68% in declining context say that they strongly agree or agree with that particular statement. Now, if we're going to be completely honest, as social scientists hopefully are, as we lean into this data, we would say, and we would expect that many who are attending congregations want to think the best of themselves. We want to have positive self-evaluations that, of course, our neighborhood would notice if we were no longer here. It is quite another thing to actually go and talk to one's neighbors. So if you were to do this in your own context, if you were to actually go to the local businesses and homeowners and those who live in different condos and so forth and ask them, you know, tell me, what do you think about, I'll use my own church example, Skyview Community Church of the Nazarene. What do you think about Skyview? Have you heard of them? Are your thoughts generally positive, negative, neutral, etc.? It would be interesting to do that kind of study and then compare that with what church leaders say. And to what extent do those data points align or not? I think that latter question is actually the more interesting one. And our research team with a group of scholars across the country are charting out in the not too distant future to do some in-depth case studies with churches across the country. And part of our intention pre-COVID was to actually incorporate this kind of question where you could go around your neighborhood and ask some of these questions. And so we'll see if we can tap into some of this data. But I think that is an important thing. We can't just look at our self-assessment. We need to actually talk to our neighbors, engage their thoughts and experiences of one's congregation in the community. We heard lots of fascinating examples of churches who were trying to make a positive impact in their neighborhood. And this is just a sampling of those. One church shared with us that they partake in the Eucharist every single week. And when people partake in the Eucharist, when they come to the table, they bring, each individual or family will bring fresh fruit and vegetables and put it in a basket beside the Eucharist table. And it's a reminder both that they come to the table with a sense of abundance, but also in an act of generosity that we want to give this fresh fruit and vegetable in their context to families in need within their community around. And so this is a weekly practice as they engage their community. Another congregation engaging university students in their neighborhoods. They asked university students in their neighborhood what it is that they wanted or needed. And they talked about they want a space to study and they want good food. And so once a week, this church puts on an event for university students to come together and eat and hang out with one another and study. Community gardens, we hear more and more stories of this. One church shares stories of local university students who designed a community garden and all the produce was donated to recent immigrants in the family. And then more recently, this is actually just during the pandemic, a congregation that provided what they called a weeping tree. And so during the season of Lent, neighbors in the community could write out the things that they were lamenting. And they would write those things down on a ribbon and they would hang it on this tree. And during the period of Lent, this tree out in the neighborhood for that community was filled with the laments of members of that community. And then that church prayed each week for the different areas of lament. So again, just different ideas and examples of innovation, if you will, for engaging the community. So some questions, some opportunities to give consideration to. I mean, many of you will be familiar with what I'll put our own sort of the broad tent, James Watson and his fantastic work in community-based work, and many different examples out of his work and some others that we unpack within our research on opportunities for tangible actions and next steps and partnerships to engage in one's neighborhood. And so these are some possibilities in your own context. So, you know, what does it look like to just walk the neighborhood? What do you learn by walking the neighborhood? There was a fascinating study by geographers a number of years ago where they were interviewing church leaders and they asked them to draw a picture of their neighborhood. And it was fascinating to see how in some contexts, those who knew their neighborhood quite well were very detailed and accurate in depicting, you know, the particular cornerstone and here's where Mrs. Jones lives and so forth. And others who were wildly inaccurate on what was in their neighborhood or community in their drawing. So just walking the neighborhood can open our eyes to who and what exists within our community. Of actually talking with neighbors. What does it look like to talk with our neighbors, to learn about who lives there, to learn about their needs, their areas of interest, and so forth. Of reading local newsletters, finding out what are the topics of issue, of interest, and so forth within our community. Of learning the demographics of the community, and we provide some resources and tools and signs of life that can help congregations to do that. So do you know, what are the age demographics? And when you look at ethnicity, when you look at socioeconomic status, gender, family type, and so forth, these fairly basic entrance points to learning about one's community can be quite powerful and significant to then take some next steps. And then finally, and there are many other ideas to be sure, hosting roundtables, some congregations who are inviting different stakeholders within the community, leaders from local schools and libraries and police force and businesses and restaurants and so forth coming together to talk about, you know, what are the things we love about our community? What are the things that are working well? What are the areas of concern? What are people already doing in response to some of those concerns? And how might we explore partnerships? So different examples, ways of engaging one's own neighborhood. And then finally, the topic of evangelism. And this builds in some broad respects on neighborhood engagement, though they are distinct areas. We know that congregations grow in one of three ways. One is transfer growth, either people leaving one church to go to another church within the same city or town. this also includes people who move, say, from Calgary to Toronto. If I attend my church here in Calgary, now I move to Toronto and I'm looking for a church there. This is another type of transfer growth. And also we would include in this category those who immigrate. So those who immigrate, who are attending a church in a different country before coming to Canada, who then are looking for a church here in Canada. And we know that immigration certainly is fueling much of the life and vitality in Catholic and evangelical contexts in particular. Second, you have births and retention. So those who have children and more children, it's a fantastic church growth strategy as you have a lot of children and you actually retain them. This is another form of church growth. And then third is conversion. And this intersects with the topic of evangelism. We know, as Sarah Wilkins-Laflamme and I talked about in None of the Above, that religious nuns, those who say they have no religion, is the fastest growing religious group in Canada and many modern Western nations today. A quarter of Canadian adults and a third of Canadian teens. And this is really the wheelhouse of this conversation, I would say, of evangelism, that if we want to do evangelism well, we need to understand those who say they have no religion. How do they see the world? What's their background? How do they view religion and spirituality, broadly speaking? And so None of the Above is a book that really charts some of those data points and answers a number of those questions. In our work on congregations and returning to the congregational survey, we do ask questions about evangelism. And we try to unpack a myriad of questions related to how important evangelism is, do people evangelize, and what forms, and so forth. So this question, our congregation gives a high or essential priority to evangelism. Comparing between growing and declining contexts on the far left-hand side, you find that 37% of those in growing contexts give a high or essential priority versus 17% within declining contexts. On the far right-hand side, and quite, I would say, quite important to note, is the neutral or unsure responses ranging from 22 to 29%. You know, sometimes we too quickly dismiss these neutral or unsure categories. We infer that, well, they don't really know, they're unsure, and so that's not really helpful data to us. And yet, as a social scientist, I would say it's quite helpful data on this question, because if congregants are telling us that they're neutral or unsure on this question of whether a congregation gives a high or essential priority to evangelism, if nothing else, it probably tells us that at the very least, evangelism is not a high priority. In other words, if you can't discern if evangelism is a high priority within your congregation, this probably is one indicator that it likely is not a high or essential priority within a congregational setting. Another way of putting this is, if you think evangelism ought to be an important priority within your congregation, to what extent is this front and center among the various activities within one's congregational life? And it seems to be, as kind of an initial barometer here, that those in growing contexts seem to be more likely to give a high or essential priority to evangelism. Second, we asked individuals about different ways in which they evangelize, if you will. And I'll say right off the bat, we're just about to release a version 2.0 of our survey. And we very much broadened this particular area of the survey to look at a many number other ways by which individuals might evangelize. But these three initial barometers, I think, give us a bit of a touch point for engaging this. So this captures data on individuals who do this monthly or more. So I show my faith to non-Christians, and this is with the pretext or the idea that that this might actually invite a person into a deeper faith with Jesus or into Christian faith or community. So 95% say that monthly or more, they show their faith to others. So an example is I shovel my neighbor's walk. My neighbor's 92 years old. And so I'm showing my faith with the idea or hope that this is a tangible expression of the gospel. And perhaps it might serve as an avenue by which they might notice those things, potentially ask me about my faith, and an opportunity to potentially, in the second context here, actually share my faith. Those who verbally share their faith with non-Christians, it's a more assertive form, if you will, of sharing one's faith, of proclaiming the good news, if you will. And then third, inviting non-Christians to one's church. We see at 17%. This isn't perfect per se in terms of thinking about this along a continuum, but you might think of showing one's faith as the most passive form of evangelism, and inviting someone to one's church is perhaps the most assertive form by which one might show their faith. And what I would say, not just from this data, but other research as well in Canada, is that there is, generally speaking, an aversion to more assertive forms of evangelism for all kinds of social and cultural and historical reasons, that we are far more comfortable doing these more passive forms of evangelism, that I could be a good, nice, kind, tolerant person, if you will, to those around me, hoping that they maybe ask me why I'm kind and generous and so forth, and then this is my opportunity to share one's faith. And I'm not convinced, looking at the data, hearing lots of anecdotal stories in various contexts across the country, I'm not convinced that this is a particularly effective form of evangelism. If you just think in your own experiences, the last time someone asked you why you were a kind or pleasant person, why you did these nice things for them or for others, as a gateway for evangelism per se. And so there is a variation here. I will also note, when it comes to inviting a person to one's church, that we know that this is one of the lead catalysts for people who actually connect to a faith community. Now, attending church is not the total sum of joining a faith community per se, but it is one marker. And we know that personal invitation from family and friends is the number one catalyst for a person to actually join a religious community. We then asked individuals to highlight for us the greatest challenges for them personally in evangelism. And here you see the top five things. We gave a long list. We asked them to identify the top three challenges, and here are the top five. Lack of confidence, 42%, increased antagonism or resistance to Christian values and the Christian church, 34%, fear of rejection, 29%, few non-believers as friends, 25%, and lack of training, 23%. If I were leading a church, and I'm not a pastor, I'm not a clergy member, I am a social scientist, but if I were leading a church, I would look at this kind of data and ask myself the question, what are the areas whereby I as a leader and us as a congregation can help equip and empower those within our congregation in areas whereby they find evangelism challenging? When it comes to lack of confidence, for example, lack of training, how do we actually equip and empower members in our community toward this end? And so this is where I think data can help to inform some of the practices within a local church setting. And so the last thing I want to say, and then we'll open it up for some questions and conversation. When it comes to one's own congregation, if evangelism is particularly important, or we aspire for it to be important, how central is evangelism within one's congregation? Going back to that first survey question earlier on, in terms of how much priority do we actually give to it? How much airtime does it receive within the different ministry areas of our congregation? To what extent do we teach on it? And here we're not just talking about frequency, but we're talking about the content. What is the basis by which we frame and talk about evangelism? So if I'm thinking as a sociologist of religion in Canada, I'm talking about the growth of those who say they have no religion in Canada, that we can't take for granted that my neighbor or my coworker knows anything about the Christian gospel or message, unlike previous generations who at least more than likely had some degree of familiarity within that setting. So we're talking about a different starting point altogether. How do we actually equip people for evangelism? And this points to the recent slide and data on the barriers and challenges that people experience. How are we actually equipping people toward that end? What opportunities are there for evangelism? And, you know, some congregations are working with something like Alpha or other programs like that, that provide opportunities for congregations to come together in a concerted effort toward evangelism within their social sphere, their neighbors, their coworkers, their family and friends, and so forth. They can actually rally people together. This might involve things like block parties. If we talk about neighborhood, What does it look like for my wife and I to host a big block party in our neighborhood and community? And this is something we're giving consideration to when the pandemic is over, to host a massive block party and to make it an annual type thing. How do we do these things with an eye towards ongoing fostering of relationships with our neighbors, whereby evangelism is certainly part of it, but it's not the total sum? These opportunities, I think, are significant. Celebrations. To what extent do we celebrate those who are new to the faith community? Some congregations will do this in and through sharing stories and testimonies, those who are new to the faith. And this serves a powerful sociological function, both for the new convert, but also for the rest of the faith community, because it sometimes can awaken things in us that we perhaps forgot about when we were new to the faith. It awakens the sense of urgency and life transformation that happens for those who have come to faith that might ask this question of, to what extent might I participate in these things in my community around? And then finally, measurements. Whether you like measurements or not, it is one barometer for assessing both how central evangelism or any of these other markers are, but then how effective we are. And so if the ledger sheet, so to speak, has a consistent flat line in terms of like zero new converts or new baptisms or what have you, then what might we do in response to that data relative to our evangelistic efforts? And so in our chapter on evangelism, we talk about some ideas and provide some resources that might be helpful toward that end. So to conclude, many different areas one could think about in terms of life and vitality within Canadian congregations, but my goal and my intention here is that data would inform practice, that data is not something to be feared, but it's actually something to be embraced within the right context. And hopefully some of our work at the Institute and some of our other research would be helpful to local church leaders for the sake of congregations who are seeking to flourish within the things they believe God is calling them to do and to be. So I will stop there and happy to open it up for some questions and conversation.
Thank you, Joel, for that excellent presentation. You've given us a lot to think about. And I'll just remind you, if you have any questions, to put them in the chat, and I'll keep an eye on that. First, I wanted to just start off, though, by asking, you know, you talk about innovation, and you know, you're an expert on Canada, right, and the Canadian sort of context and culture. And is there a bit of an anti-innovation kind of, or maybe are Canadians not as innovative as others? I mean, especially thinking of American culture, which tends to be more entrepreneurial. People will talk about the frontier mentality. And I remember what Northrop Frye comparing Canada and America said, you know, Americans have a frontier mentality. Canadians have a garrison mentality. It's like, we just want to get into the fort and hunker down. Right. And it's, do you think that's the case? And do you see that in your research on Canadian churches?
Yeah, I think there's an element of truth to that. And this is partially a reflection of the different expressions of religion in both countries. So, for example, evangelicalism is much larger in the United States than it is in Canada, right? Canada is dominated by more mainline Protestant traditions and Catholicism that, generally speaking, are not known for innovation, for being on the frontier entrepreneurial context. So I think there's an element of that. What is interesting in our research is that innovation is often spurred when groups have their back against the wall, i.e. our numbers are dwindling. Like if we don't do something, we're actually going to close or we're going to have to shut down, these kinds of things. And for some, that has been the best thing for them because they've had to try, like just throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and see what sticks. And while that isn't necessarily my advice for the best pathway towards flourishing, it can be effective for some because they have nothing left to lose. And so we have seen different areas of flourishing in that respect.
Mm, okay. Thank you very much. We have a question from Jane Peck, and she asks, what are some examples of on-ramps for people moving from online viewing to deeper levels of involvement? Have you encountered any of those?
Yeah, great, great question. So some congregations are providing opportunities to meet with other pastors and clergy or newcomers from One's Church. So for example, you're like, hey, we're thrilled all of you have joined us for this service. You know, one of the things we're really interested in this church is helping people to learn more about some of our pastors, those on staff, meet some of the others in our congregation. And so this Wednesday night, we're going to gather on Zoom with those of you who are joining. So it's an explicit invitation. This is comparable to churches in an in-person context who might have like a monthly newcomers gathering. So on the last Sunday, we're going to have a potluck for anyone who's new to our church and wants to learn a bit more about us, for us to learn a bit more about you, those kinds of things. To explicitly name that, you know, we want those who associate with this congregation to become more involved, that actually we don't want to encourage a passive form of observance, what sociologists of religion call free riders. And this isn't intended in a pejorative way, but basically people who are just consuming but not contributing. And so we'll actually name that and then provide opportunities for, you know, we've got some midweek gatherings in these different areas. And so we'd like to encourage you to join in for one of those things. So those would be different examples of explicitly naming that we actually want people to be actively involved. And here's why we think that's beneficial. And then to provide an opportunity, whether it's meeting with clergy, meeting with other members, or it might be through volunteering. So some will say, you know, we're doing more of this tech related stuff right now. We're looking for people who have skills in these different areas. And maybe this is like your third time joining us, and maybe you have some expertise, that volunteering can be a primary avenue to actually get to know others within one's congregational community and become more involved. So a few examples anyways that I've seen or heard during the pandemic and before.
Great, great. Thank you. There's no one else asking anything right now, so if anyone has something, please feel free to post it, but I'll throw out another one. The meaning of neighborhood is an interesting question, and it varies, right? If you're comparing a small town in a rural context versus a, you know, an older part of a big city versus a suburban sort of environment, right? So I'm thinking particularly where Tyndale is and the sort of inner suburbs of Toronto. They don't have much of a neighborhood feel, right? The streets, the urban planning, the major arteries are designed more like highways than anything else. And people don't live with much of a sense of neighborhood because it's not laid out that way. They drive everywhere and so forth. And so sometimes also churches in those contexts mimic the ethos around, right? So you have people driving from all over who don't live in the neighborhood. And so there's this ongoing discussion, right, in church leadership. Okay, what do you do then? Do you try to refocus your church on the physical neighborhood where your building is? But then you're sort of fighting against the whole way everything's designed and the way people live their lives, but maybe that's the best way. Or do you encourage people to engage their own neighborhoods wherever they are? Or what are you seeing in that respect? And you know, what's your gut tell you as a social science researcher?
Yeah, we deal with all these scenarios in our chapter on this subject because this is the lived experience with so much variety. So the short answer is all of the above, right? So this is a combination of the physical neighborhood that I personally live in, as well as the physical neighborhood around the church building, if it's located within a particular neighborhood that warrants that kind of engagement. I mean, this is a challenge. This is a shifting reality, particularly in large urban centers where people are commuting further and further away to the churches that they attend because of the different choices that are available to them, or where their particular denominational allegiances lay in, and where the closest church might be in that context. So, and it does reflect, and I don't mean this again in a pejorative way, but a bit of the consumerist or individualist narrative that we have within society, that I'll actually drive by this church in my denomination to get to the next one in my denomination because I like that one better for a variety of reasons. So you have that, and then you have others who are definitely moving towards more of a parish mentality. That is, we actually want people to be embedded in this physical community, and we want people to attend this church who live in this community, and we want to collectively partner together to impact this community. In other words, some churches will actively discourage people who are driving more than 10 minutes away from attending this particular church because of the particular ethos that they're trying to engage. So I think you see all of those things in play. I think what's important for churches to do is to clearly articulate what they mean by neighborhood for their particular setting, and then to intentionally seek out what it means to positively impact that neighborhood, whether it's around the church building, where congregants live, or a combination thereof. And of course, the strategies are different, right? If you live in a high-rise condo in downtown Toronto, for example, that will look very differently than if you're in the suburbs and so forth. So giving attention to those particularities.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah, we've got a couple questions come in now. Bob Ward asks, did you find organizational ethos from your pie chart had an overriding positive, negative, or neutral impact on evangelism and innovation?
Yeah, I would say the key dynamic within organizational ethos pertains to structures and processes. And I didn't go through those earlier, but structures and processes means that there's a degree of intentionality and there's a clear system by which we draw people into these particular areas, whether it's innovation or evangelism. That is, evangelism is important. Here are some specific steps that we're taking to help equip and empower. And here are the particular initiatives that we're taking as a church to evangelize. So that's what I mean by structures and processes, that those things are particularly key. And I would say this, that overall, actually, for flourishing, that few churches flourish by accident, that churches almost always flourish with a high degree of intentionality, that we are intentionally pursuing these things and we seek to align the dots, the structures and processes that help us to get from A to Z, however defined, on different areas. And that is one of the recurring threads that ties these groups together. So as a social scientist, I would say congregations are human organizations. They are run by humans, they are guided by human interests and human decisions, etc. And yes, theologically, there are all kinds of things that we do and we believe relative to prayer and the work of God and the Spirit of God and so forth, but these things are also running in parallel tracks to what we do as humans, as a human organization. And that's where I think those structures and processes are particularly important. And it's important to have leaders who think in those kinds of ways. And it doesn't mean that your senior leader needs to do all of those things or think in that way. But if that is the case, it means you need to surround that leader with others in leadership who do think that way so that you can help to align the dots so that there's a clear synergy that moves in that kind of direction on any of those topics, whether it's evangelism, innovation, or so forth.
Very good. And I would say that's a very Wesleyan insight because, you know, when we look at early Methodism and what separated from other revival movements at the time, right, is that they were organized and there were other preachers who were better than John Wesley. There were other revivals that were more dramatic, but Methodism had a lasting impact because of the structures they put in place. So it's not to think of things like prayer and the work of the Spirit as opposed to organization and structure, that God can use those things. Karen Haft is asking, as we move to healing treaty relationships with our Indigenous nations in Canada, have you seen much on how we change the words of conversion to more of journey or circular language that Wesley was known for? And how can we as a church congregations participate in this journey?
Yeah, great question. Language comes with baggage in a variety of contexts. And this is certainly one of those contexts. And I certainly hear many different church environments using different language, whether it's journey, whether it's kind of on a shared path together, doing life together. I mean, there's all kinds of synonyms. I don't mean to dismiss the question or the particular language, but at the end of the day, we are talking about a similar phenomena, but it's different language to capture it in ways that are more understandably so, given the social context here in Canada with Indigenous communities, that the language might be different, but the same kind of undercurrent is still present. Now, there's a much larger question to be asked there then of what does it actually look like to engage in relationship with people, potentially for the purposes of evangelism, but maybe to the exclusion of evangelism as well. And there's some really good writing that's coming out these days that engages that question. What is the purpose for being in relationship with others, full stop? With relationship with my neighbors, with Indigenous communities, with whatever the different type of community in question is. And while, yes, there might be a narrative of evangelism, and this is where theology matters greatly, how do we theologize about evangelism? What is it? What is the end goal? What are the intermediate steps, etc.? Because that profoundly impacts practice of how I think about what I'm doing when I'm talking with my neighbors, when I'm having people in my home for dinner, like all those kinds of things. I think that's probably the stronger undercurrent. And what happens when it seems like a person is potentially not going to join our religious group or isn't going to take steps closer towards a personal relationship with Jesus, to be quite sort of evangelical or orthodox in how that's understood? I think those are some of the larger questions. But absolutely, language matters in terms of how we frame those things. And I think some are moving away from even the language of evangelism, because that comes with its own baggage, or conversion. So those things are out there. But I still think, as a social scientist, the underlying phenomena is fairly similar, regardless of the language that's being used.
Okay, thank you. According to the schedule, our time is up. I did have two more questions, which, Joel, I don't know if you mind answering them. If people want to leave and take their full 15-minute break, please feel free to do so. But we'll just take up these two more questions for those who want to stay and listen. Ellie has asked, do you have data on homogenous cultural subgroup trying to engage in a different cultural environment? And Pastor Ellie is a pastor of a Filipino Methodist church, so I know that's why he's interested in that question.
Yeah, lots of really good research coming out on this, particularly in the United States and a little bit in Canada. There's so many directions to go here. I mean, I suppose the short answer from data is that the most effective form for engaging different cultural communities is including different voices within positions of leadership, and then trickling through different aspects of congregational life, so that it avoids sort of that classic missionary posture of us coming to help you, and a very kind of strong line between the two. What does it look like to facilitate and foster relationships with people of different communities, and then including those voices in leadership discussions and in different leadership activities? And this just, I mean, it sounds simplistic, and I don't mean for it to come across simplistically, but this does grow out of personal relationships that people have. So to what extent do we know those in our neighborhood or community? Like, go to the local restaurant and get to know folks who are running that restaurant, or the local business within the neighborhood, or within one's physical neighborhood they live in, of having people over for dinner from different cultural communities and contexts, etc. I think it grows out of those personal relationships first and foremost that can help to bridge a gateway or pathway to be trusted and to be known, and sharing over food. I mean, this is a common conduit, if you will, for fostering those relationships. But the leadership piece is key, particularly as groups seek to become more multi-ethnic and multiracial in its configuration. And it has just a ripple effect on from the music that's sung, to the programs that are run, to who's making decisions for the congregation as a whole, that these things are all pertinent. So yeah, that's probably a short and too simplistic response. There is a lot of data. We do cite a bunch of that data in our chapter on diversity that would be quite helpful on that front.
Okay, so a good plug for the book there, to pick up that copy. And Tabitha did list it in the chat here a little earlier. Last question. It seems Zoom, this is Dennis Chadwick, it seems Zoom has the potential to take us back to the days of circuit or itinerant preachers, but there does seem to me a preference for local people to gather virtually locally, even though they can tune into services all over the world. Is this inward looking, comfortable, or something more being expressed here?
Yeah, I think, and correct me if I haven't understood the question correctly here, but I think there is, actually, sorry, can I just get you to repeat the question, James, or just clarify?
Sure. Well, I think since we're late on time, I won't ask him to come on and explain, but I think what he's saying is, even though we can tune in the services anywhere, people still seem to prefer to tune into their local church, right? And so what's going on there? Is that you know, I guess that's what's behind that, I guess, is his question.
Yeah, that's great. That's helpful. Thank you. I think there's something about the personal social ties within one's local community. There's a sense of familiarity and progressively embedding oneself within their life. And I haven't done research on this. Maybe there's research out there, but I imagine that most who are tuning into churches from afar, who might may or may not be plugged into a local congregation are obviously doing so for the preaching or the music or what have you, that they aren't doing so for the sake of community. And there's a very distinct reality that's present within those settings. I think those who are doing so local, there is that community piece that is one of the central hubs that draws people together. It's one of the reasons we see within that Angus Reid survey that I noted earlier, why people are continuing to plug in by and large throughout the pandemic here, why I think people will return. By and large, there are always exceptions to in-person services when they're able to. There is that value for community, and that watching services from afar is either augmenting for some what they're already doing, and there is data in that Angus Reid study that shows that what people are doing in their local setting, that they're also tuning into some of these other groups. And then you do have that fraction that in sort of at the most extreme end are the most passive forms of engagers, if you will, with local churches by tracking from afar without any kind of local involvement, if you will. So yeah, sorry, I hope I've answered that somewhat sufficiently.
I think so. And thank you very much for your presentation, Joel. It's been wonderful, and appreciate you being here, and you've given us a lot to think about. It's been a pleasure.